From NPR News, this is All Things Considered, and I'm Michelle Norris with some advice. Lighten up. This is not a segment on pop psychology. I'm talking about packing, and specifically the need to pack lighter, because more and more airlines are charging to check a second bag. Starting next week, AirTran joins Northwest, Delta, US Air, United, and Continental in requiring a fee if you can't cram all your clothes, shoes, books, hair dryers, you name it, into one checked bag. Well, we turned to Doug Diamond to get some advice on how to pare down the packing load. Diamond created OneBag.com, that's a website devoted to the art of traveling light. When I spoke to Mr. Diamond, he was prepping for a trip to India and Russia, two very different climates, and he was packing just one bag he planned to carry on. He says a key to his art is following a master list that he's been developing for years.
If it's not on your list, it shouldn't be in your bag. What happens with people is that they pack the night before their trip, and that packing activity consists mostly of talking to yourself and saying, well, I might need this, and I might need that, and what if the queen invites me to dinner, and all of that sort of thing. And that's death to light packing. So well in advance of your trip, you should have thought about what your list looks like. You should have it literally written down, and you should check it off as you go.
Now, you cite this old adage, to bring half as much clothing and twice as much money as you think you might need. But as I look at this list, it's four columns long. It's a pretty big list. How do you fit all this in one bag, and one bag that you can carry on that you don't have to check?
Well, specifically, it's well over 100 items on the list. So you're right, it's a big list. But most of the things on the list are very small. They don't take up much space. They don't add much weight. Don't forget also that this list is an all-inclusive list. It includes the things that you wear. So your coat and one of the shirts and one of the skirts or pairs of trousers and one of the sets of underwear, those are on you, not in the bag.
Is there an art to packing things well and making sure that you can pack as much as you need in as small amount of space as possible? What is the best way to fill that suitcase?
Well, there are really only two things that I would label as tricks other than just plain good old common sense. First of all, you shouldn't let any spaces go unused. So if you're packing a pair of running shoes, say, don't forget there's a lot of space inside those shoes that you could use to pack stuff. So things like that. And I guess the main trick is how you deal with clothing, because most people don't know how to pack clothing very well. They fold each item individually, pack them in a stack, and then force them into the bag somehow, which is just about the worst thing you can do as far as packing clothing goes. So there is a technique for packing clothing. It's called bundle wrapping, and it's a way of putting all your clothing in a bundle, for want of a better word, that keeps it from getting wrinkled and crumpled and also takes up less space.
When you're talking about bundling these items, are you talking about, for instance, taking a shirt, putting the bundle inside the shirt, and then wrapping one sleeve over, the shirt tail up and over the bundle and then the collar? Is that what you're talking about? Or are you talking about sort of rolling it from the bottom?
No, I'm not talking about rolling. Rolling is better than individually folding and stacking, but it's not much better. You described it pretty well. If you think of lying a shirt flat on your bed and then placing this bundle where the chest would go and then gently wrap the sleeves around the bundle and then bring the bottom up and wrap it around the top.
Shoes, they take up a lot of space.
They do. They're the single bulkiest item, and the biggest secret there is just not to take too many shoes. I guess never take more than two pairs of shoes, and frequently I take one pair of shoes. So lots of business situations these days, you can buy shoes that are quite dressy looking, and yet their internal construction is more like a high-quality running shoe.
No,
and I find that works for most things.
I have to interrupt you, and someone may snatch my feminist card from me, but there are women who are listening thinking, one pair of shoes for an entire week? Is that even possible?
Well, of course. The ladies do tend to complain a little more about that constriction than others. But even women mostly can get by with a pair of low heels and a pair of sort of dressy, strappy kind of sandals. I mean, those two things will handle most kinds of travel that you want. If it's cold weather, then a pair of boots with short heels would be better than the strappy sandals. But most women can really get by with two pairs if they wish. But, of course, they always have the option of carrying seven suitcases and dragging half their belongings around the world with them.
Or buying shoes when you get there.
Or buying shoes when they get there, yes. So that's what you do when you do get invited for dinner with the queen.
Ah, okay. Thanks so much for joining us on Bon Voyage.
Thanks, Michelle.
That was Doug Diamond. He's a frequent traveler and creator of OneBag.com. To see a diagram of his bundling wrapping method, you can go to our website, npr.org.
Going into its seventh year of war, the Army is greatly in need of new recruits and is happy to take those who are much older. In this part of the program, we'll hear about one of them, a new recruit who turned 56 this week. Specialist Tom Owens fought in Vietnam, two tours, while serving 14 years in the Army. Then he ran a landscaping business, which he sold when he learned that his prior service qualified him to rejoin the Army. He's now assigned to an Army Reserve unit in Gainesville, Georgia. NPR's Kathy Lohr has this story.
Specialist Tom Owens enlisted in the Army when he was 17 years old. Now, almost 40 years later, he's back.
Company! Attention!
It's 7:15 on Saturday morning, and three dozen soldiers dressed in Army fatigues stand at attention. Many are in their 20s, some even in their 30s, but no one stands out more than Tom Owens. 6'3", 220 pounds, and an Army buzz cut that took off most of his gray hair.
Stand at.
Here in formation is about the only time you'll catch Owens without his infectious smile. The soldiers are about to be tested on their physical fitness, so they head to a local junior college. Owens is more than ready.
You'll be my greater Evans. Come on.
Even before the test begins, you can see how this Vietnam vet interacts with younger soldiers. He's a take-charge kind of guy and stops to adjust the beret for his grader, Specialist Chad Evans. More than three decades separate the two.
I'm trying to get him on the right path to being a good leader. Let me fix your hat.
Is it all messed up?
Yeah. Yeah, he must have slept in it last night.
All right.
What do you want him to do?
Owens jokes with everyone about how many push-ups and sit-ups he can do, only he's not kidding.
Get ready. 1 minute. Get set. Begin.
Count them out. One, two.
In the 2 minutes allotted for each exercise, this 56-year-old completes 47 push-ups and 60 sit-ups. Sergeant First Class Deborah Vincent is among those watching.
I'm not going to say anything about his age, but he's in very, very good shape. And to come back in after all these years, you know, I commend him for that because the younger soldiers look up to him. If he can do stuff, they can do it. And you'll see him on his PT test.
After the first part of the test is over, the soldiers head for a 2-mile run. Owens finishes in 17 and a half minutes. Then he drops, does another 25 push-ups, and runs back to encourage others who've yet to finish.
Let's go, huh? Looking good. You make it look so easy. Huh?
Back at the Army Reserve Center, the veteran shows me some old photos taken when he served in Vietnam. He was tall, thin, and 18 years old, but looks much younger.
I was on the DMZ. That's North Vietnam. They were flying on a chopper. They're fixing to drop us off into the field. They're shooting at us, and we're shooting at them, and very dangerous.
He remembers well patrolling in the northernmost reaches of South Vietnam. In May 1971, a rocket exploded in a bunker, killing 29 members of his unit and injuring dozens of others. Owens received a Bronze Star and several other medals.
You know, I'm a survivor, and I'm young. I stood tall in a place of hell with other Americans to doing a job and nobody else wanted to do. I have no regrets. Do it all over again, you know. It's what it's all about.
Owens admits some of the younger soldiers tease him and call him Grandpa, but they also know he can outperform many of them. He did finish the Ironman triathlon back in the 1980s. Initially, even some recruiters told him he wouldn't make it back in the Army. That only made him more determined.
Tell me I can't do something and I will do it. You know, when people say I couldn't go in the Army, I said I will go in the Army.
Since the Iraq War began, the Army has raised its age limit to attract more recruits and increase its ranks. Battalion Commander Lieutenant Colonel Dave Johnson drove 3 hours to congratulate Owens personally.
Maybe some other guys that haven't reached the mandatory retirement age might see this and think, you know, the Army, you know, maybe it's not such a bad thing, and maybe they might come back. So I think it's just incredible that he's doing this.
Open ranks, pump!
This new, or should I say old, recruit is ready to be back in the thick of things.
I didn't join the Army to be behind a desk somewhere. My intention is to be on the front lines with them and supporting the war effort the best I can.
Second, third, fourth squad, 80.
When Tom Owens left the military in 1992, he was a sergeant. But Owens had to drop a rank when he rejoined the reserves. He expects to make sergeant again later this year and then hopes to be deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
To see Tom Owens as he aces his PT test, go to NPR.org. One of opera's most adored spectacles, Aida, opens tonight at the Portland Opera in Oregon. Alchemy will be in the air as 70 men and women hang up their street clothes, trade in their separate selves, and combine to create a single character, the operatic chorus. Whether that character wears the costumes of Egyptian priests or Spanish gypsies, the opera chorus, as much as any soloist, can make a good production sublime. NPR senior correspondent Ketzel Levine has their story.
We're eavesdropping on chorus member Joanna Siciliani singing to a CD in her car. Sounds just like you, right? Could be, with a certain innate talent, if not confidence. In fact, Joanna Siciliani had such a lack of confidence, she told no one in her family she'd auditioned for the Portland Opera Chorus until she got in.
And I don't think I've ever been as happy when I got the letter saying, we'd like you to be in these two operas. I mean, maybe when I had my children, but it was fabulous. Let me take
a girl. Enveloped in music, we arrive at the Riverside headquarters of the Portland Opera, where syllable by syllable, beat by beat, Aida is coming to life. Keeping his flock in tight formation, meet chorus master Rob Ainsley.
3, 4. It's so exciting when that happens. There's nothing, the bigger the chorus, the more exciting it is when everything happens at exactly the same time. It's like magic. Same thing, once more.
The real magic is the delight Rob Ainsley takes and puts into rehearsals while so focused on sound and sensibilities.
Now together. In a chorus, the instruments they're using are physically a part of themselves, and therefore there's a much more emotional attachment to that instrument. If someone is singing as loudly as they can, because that's how they feel it, and when you ask them to do it less loudly, it's almost kind of a personal affront to them.
And why would you want to offend a teacher, a trucker, a coffee barista? The Portland Opera Chorus is dominated by folks with day jobs, though each is a card-carrying member of the American Guild of Musical Artists. All are paid, but not all comers are welcome. It's tough to get into this chorus. Sidle up to a couple of the bass baritones, and you'll hear why. The clear tone of Brandon Langford. The resonance of Andre Flynn. And the physicality of Barton Rippey, one of the few full-time musicians in the chorus, who plays, tunes, and teaches piano, in addition to singing in the opera.
I'm a good singer, but I don't think I would have been good enough to really make a good living to justify being a soloist. Because to do that, you would have to give up, I believe, a lot of things. And I see soloists come through who have given up things like family, home, and really coming to terms with where I'm at this point in time.
With the opening of Aida weeks ahead, weeks that will fly by, chorus rehearsal chugs along, evenings, weekends, in the shower, in the car. Meanwhile, there are costume fittings with Frances Britt, who made her debut with the Portland Opera Chorus in 1964. Frances Britt is now the costume shop manager.
Okay, so holler when you get in it.
Okay.
And the woman has collected a patchwork of stories, like the time when the Duke in Rigoletto had a small onstage faux pas.
The Duke had lace-up boots
and he tore the crotch out of his breeches, and there was no time to take him out of the boots so that I could sew him on the machine. Just I got down on my knees and I just stitched him up by hand, and the sweat was just running down. That's probably my most memorable moment. Yeah.
The chorus is getting tighter, sharper, the change in energy palpable as weeks left of rehearsal dwindle to days. It's likely not on anyone's radar that singing has been proven to release endorphins, increase serotonin, fight depression. They're all too blissed out.
You have this entire range of emotions within you.
Tenor Mike Milholland.
You don't get very many situations that allow you to express those emotions. But in opera, you get them all. You can just pour them out, and your whole life expands.
And that goes double for bass baritone Carlo Antonucci.
If I can use this analogy, I mean, it may be in some way when two people connect on a relationship level, whether it's physically, intimacy, all at the same time.
Are you trying to say it's sort of like great sex?
Well, yeah. I think that's how it is.
So you gotta ask yourself, why aren't you in a chorus? The curtain goes up tonight on the Portland Opera production of Verdi's Aida, starring, in case you hadn't noticed, the Portland Opera Chorus. Ketzel Levine, NPR News.
You can watch the Portland Opera Chorus rehearse Aida with chorus master Rob Ainsley and discover more music at npr.org/music.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ira Glass.
And I'm Michelle Norris. And I am delighted to say hello to Ira Glass, who's visiting us from This American Life, coming back to All Things Considered.
Yes, and I am delighted to be here. All Things Considered was my home for over a decade. I was an All Things Considered producer before I ever went on the air myself.
And you come back bearing gifts with this wonderful collaboration.
Yes, this is a collaboration which is designed to take advantage of the incredible expertise NPR News has when it comes to all matters of economic analysis and business analysis, and also took advantage of the documentary powers of our staff, where we can spend months tracking down people and finding people for just one story. And so we did both those things to put together this story.
And this story involving the subprime mortgage crisis, something that tops the news many days, but you take us much deeper into this.
Well, we had this question, which truthfully, with all the great coverage, we have not understood the answer to. And basically, the question had to do with these loans that banks would give out at the height of the crisis that are at the heart of this crisis. And basically, there are these loans where you didn't have to prove you could pay them back. You didn't have to prove you had a job. You didn't have to put money down. There's something called a NINO loan, which stands for no income, no asset. And one of our producers, Alex Bloomberg, talked to a guy who got a loan like this named Clarence Nathan. And Clarence worked 3 part-time, not very steady jobs, made about $45,000 a year. And he took out this loan against his house that was huge, really.
Call it $540 for round figures. And you basically borrowed $540,000 from the bank, and they didn't check your income.
Right. They don't call me up and say, you know, how much money. They don't do that. I mean, it's almost like you pass a guy in the street and you say, you lend me $540,000? He said, well, what do you do? I got a job. Okay. I mean, essentially, that's the process.
Would you have loaned you the money?
I wouldn't have loaned me the money. And nobody that I know would have loaned me the money. I mean, I know guys who are criminals that wouldn't lend me that money, and they break your kneecap. So, I don't know why the bank did it. I'm serious. I mean, $540,000, because with bad credit.
Ira, it's interesting to listen to this music because I feel like it should be Saturday afternoon. I'm in the car taking somebody to dance class or soccer or something like that.
I know. This music makes any story better, doesn't it?
Now, Ira, your producer, Alex Blumberg, worked with NPR's Adam Davidson to put this story together.
Yeah, the two of them went around, and they were trying to answer the question, what happened in banking? You know, what happened that the most basic rules of lending somebody money, like making sure that the person who you're lending it to can pay you back, what happened that made those go away? And they were also really interested in, you know, all these brokers and bankers who made these rules go away. They wanted to find out, like, what were they thinking? How did they see this? What did they think they were doing? They wanted to hear it in their words.
Let's hear it in their words.
When I first heard that phrase, subprime housing crisis, I thought it had all to do with the housing industry. Well, it turns out that's not exactly right. It turns out that the crisis is really about the financing and the people doing the financing.
That's right, Adam. This whole crisis really starts with what you and I have come to call the global pool of money. What that is, most people don't think about it. It's the world's investments. Pension funds investing for people's retirements, insurance companies investing your premiums, government central banks investing the wealth of nations.
A lot of money. It's about 70 trillion.
That's Jayla Pazarbasholu of the International Monetary Fund. And let's try and figure out how much is $70 trillion. Think of all the money everyone spends on Earth every year. Everything you bought in the last year, add everything the U.S. government and the U.S. military spent money on, add all the corn in Mexico and all the money folks spent on lawyers and all the rice sold in China. All the money spent everywhere on Earth in a year, that is less than $70 trillion, less than this global pool of money.
So it's a lot of money. And there's this army of people, investment managers, whose job it is to watch over that money. And they're pretty nervous because they have two sort of contradictory concerns. They don't want to lose any of it, and they also want to make it grow. So for a long time, they made it grow by investing in very safe, pretty boring investments, things like U.S. treasuries and municipal bonds.
But right before our story starts, something happened to that global pool of money. It got a lot bigger. In fact, it doubled between 2000 and 2006. In other words, several centuries to get to about $35 trillion, and then over the course of 6 years, it got another $35 trillion. And there are a lot of reasons for this growth, but the main one was that a lot of countries that used to be poor, that used to have no real savings, suddenly became rich. Brazil, India, of course, China, started making things that the rich countries wanted. And those countries banked their profits and looked around the world for ways to invest them.
So suddenly there's twice as much money scouring the world for investments, but the world wasn't ready. There weren't twice as many good investments. And so this global pool of money looked around and found one investment that it liked in particular, the U.S. housing market, and a special bond created by Wall Street.
It was unbelievable. I mean, we almost couldn't produce enough to keep our investors happy.
Mike Francis worked at Morgan Stanley, the Wall Street investment bank, and he was producing these bonds that allowed global investors to buy into the U.S. housing market.
More people wanted bonds than we could actually produce. That was our difficult task, was trying to produce enough.
Here's how Mike Francis and a lot of other people on Wall Street performed this kind of financial magic of turning mortgages into bonds. They'd buy up mortgages, thousands of them, and pool them all together. That way, they'd have this constant stream of mortgage payments coming to them every month. And they would sell shares in that stream to global investors. That's how you create a mortgage-backed security, a mortgage-backed bond. And for a few years there, like between 2003 and 2006, almost nothing in the world was growing as fast as U.S. house prices, and these bonds were sort of a way for investors to get a piece of that action.
But there was a problem.
Right. There's always a problem.
Right. And the problem here was that to make a mortgage-backed security, you need a mortgage, and there weren't enough mortgages. By 2003, with super low interest rates and all this money from global investors, everyone who wanted a mortgage and who had the kind of steady income and money in the bank to afford one already had gotten a mortgage. But that global pool of money was hungrier than ever for these mortgage-backed bonds.
So Wall Street started lowering its standards. It used to be that to get a mortgage, you needed to prove that you made enough money, that you had a steady job, and that you had some assets in the bank. But starting around 2003, every month or so, Wall Street would loosen things up a bit.
I talked to a guy named Mike Garner, who worked at Silver State Mortgage in Nevada, and he told me that the standards kept falling. One month, Wall Street would say, borrowers don't have to prove how much they make. They can just state how much, and we'll trust them.
Then the next one came along, and it was,
no income verified asset. So you don't have to tell the people what you do for a living. You don't have to tell the people what you do for work. All you have to do is show that or state that you have a certain amount of money in your bank account. And then the next one that came out is just no income, no asset. So you don't have to state anything. You just have to have a credit score and a pulse.
That pulse thing, that was also optional. Like this case in Ohio where 23 dead people got mortgages.
And even some of the living weren't exactly what you'd call a good credit risk. The name of this new loan, remember, was No Income, No Asset. People in the industry called it a liar's loan. They expected people to lie. And if that sounds crazy to you, it also sounded crazy to a lot of people in the business. Here's Mike Garner.
My boss had been in the business for 25 years, and he hated those loans. He used to rant and just say, it makes me sick to my stomach, the kind of loans that we do. And, you know, he fought the owners and the sales force tooth and neck about these guidelines, and we got the same answer every time. Nope, other people are offering it, we're going to offer it too, and we're going to get more market share this way. House prices are booming, everything's going to be good.
Think about this whole thing from the standpoint of Mike Garner's boss's boss, the owner of the company. In the old days, Silver State Mortgage would have held on to that loan for 30 years, and so they'd make sure the borrower could pay it back. But now, in the new system, they held it for a month or two, then sold it to Wall Street. All that risk was someone else's problem.
And Wall Street wasn't particularly worried because they just passed the risk on to that global pool of money, to the investors. Now, we're not saying that Wall Street and Silver State were lying to the investors. Wall Street was constantly checking the risks of these mortgages. They had these fancy computer systems that constantly monitored the quality of the loans they bought. Morgan Stanley's Mike Francis.
All the data that we had to review, to look at, on loans that were years old was positive. They performed very well.
The data told them not to worry, that mortgage foreclosure rates are low, like 1 or 2%. They never go above, say, 10%. So the mortgage-backed bonds were designed to perform well, even if foreclosure rates hit some ridiculous high, like 12%.
We now know their numbers were way off, because the data they were looking at, back in 2005 and 2006, it was data from the old days, back when only qualified borrowers got loans. It wasn't data from this new world of no income, no asset loans to people with lousy credit.
Oh boy, this is a page I'd rather not look at very often.
Dan Nigro is one of the people who bought mortgage-backed bonds. He works for Dynamic Credit, a company that packaged those bonds into a new product called a CDO and then sold them to those global investors.
We're in his office and he brings up a screen on his Bloomberg terminal. It's the current statistics on one of those mortgage pools that Wall Street created that his company bought.
And the statistics are pretty bad. Nearly 41% of the pool is more than 60 days overdue. Out of that, nearly 16.5% are in foreclosure.
Remember, for this bond to keep its value, the foreclosure rate has to stay below around 10%. It's already way over that and climbing. He says it could go past 50% on this bond.
And therefore, this bond will lose money. And everyone involved in this is losing something. There are more than 4 million Americans facing foreclosure. Hundreds of mortgage companies are now bankrupt. Hundreds of thousands of people have lost their jobs. The IMF estimates that banks and investors around the world could lose more than $1 trillion. And it's not that everyone involved was entirely foolhardy. Dan Nigro and Dynamic Credit did not take these big risks. They refused to invest in the riskiest mortgages. They thought they were being conservative. And they've lost millions.
In the end, there were just so many risks you couldn't avoid them all.
You thought you were being conservative.
I'm knowing conservative. I just wasn't conservative enough.
If you were conservative enough, what would you have done?
Well, in retrospect, I probably should have found another line of business 4 years ago.
Just about everyone we talked to at every step of this chain says now that they knew something weird was going on, that the deals they struck did not feel right.
But none of them really questioned things. And why would they? Everyone was making money, right up to the day it all fell apart.
I'm Adam Davidson, NPR News.
And I'm Alex Bloomberg for This American Life.
And once again, we have the creator of This American Life, Ira Glass, with us. Ira, thank you so much for allowing us to look at this very important story through an entirely different lens.
Oh, thank you. And I hope we get to do this kind of collaboration again.
I'm going to hold you to that promise. You can tune in this weekend to hear an hour-long version of the story. It's on This American Life, which is produced by Chicago Public Radio and heard on many public radio stations. This week, a cultural milestone, a turning of the page. Harry Potter dropped off the New York Times bestseller list. This next story is about a writer whose spooky tales may be the next big thing. Her name is Stephanie Meyer. The three books in her Twilight series have already sold more than 5 million copies in the U.S., and they dominate bestseller lists for kids' books. On Tuesday, Meyer released her first book for adults. It's called The Host. NPR's Lynn Neary brings us this report about Stephanie Meyer, a Mormon mother of three who's become publishing's latest phenomenon.
Before Stephanie Meyer even thought about being a writer, she loved the Harry Potter books. So she finds it bizarre when people call her the next J.K. Rowling. Still, she admits they do have something in common.
I think the reason why we get the comparison is because our fans are actually similar. They have that same fanatical thing going on. They dress up for the events. They come out early. They're just so into the characters, and I think that's why you get the comparison.
On Tuesday in Minneapolis, the day her new book, The Host, was released, about 1,000 of those devoted fans turned out to see Meyer at the gigantic Mall of America.
So I'm done with my questions, and now I have a lot of books to sign. I know you guys want to be able to go home.
If those screams sound like what you might hear at a Hannah Montana concert, that's because Meyer's fan base is mostly teenage girls. Ontaria Hester wouldn't let her 14-year-old skip school to see Meyer, so she stood in line instead.
My daughter loves her books. Every time a new book come out, I'm at Barnes & Noble picking up the book. Every time.
Few writers can imagine this kind of commercial success. And what may be even more frustrating for those who write in obscurity is Meyer's insistence that she never set out to be a writer. The way she tells it, the Twilight series began with a dream about a vampire and a teenage girl. Meyer wanted to remember it, so she wrote it down and then began expanding on the story.
I didn't think of it as a book until the day it was finished. When I wrote the last sentence, I knew it was the last sentence. That's when I thought, wow, this is like as long as a book.
What did you think it was up until that time?
It was just this little hobby of mine where I had this story. To me, it was always just a story. And I enjoyed writing it so much that there really didn't need to be another purpose for it.
A devout Mormon, Meyer has built her empire around a story of adolescent desire. Bella, the young teenage heroine, falls in love with Edward, a vampire who refuses to drink human blood. But Edward must constantly fight his bloodlust for Bella. Time magazine described the sexual tension inherent in the story as the erotics of abstinence, a phrase that seems to embarrass Meyer.
It's really just my experience with the world and my experience with passion and the fact that when there is restraint involved, there's so much more to it. And I think that a lot of fiction and movies these days, they're really missing that beginning stage. They skip right past it.
At Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., a group of teenage fans of the Twilight series debate the relative merits of Edward the Vampire and Bella's other suitor, Jacob, a lovesick werewolf.
But why don't you like Edward? That confuses me. He's perfect.
I mean, it's not that I don't like Edward. It's just I don't like him as much as Jacob.
That's crazy.
There's no question that this group, like most of Meyer's readers, have fallen hard for Edward. 14-year-old Jojo Emerson pretty much sums it up with this description.
He's the heartthrob boy vampire lead of the Twilight series, and I think just about everyone that has ever read it would perk up at the name Edward Cullen, even if they're standing like 12 miles away.
But the girls say you don't have to like vampires to like these stories. Naran Matty says that's because Meyer's vampires are different.
They're not, you know, crazy serial killer vampires. They're really nice, articulate, polite vampires with, like, table manners.
For these young readers, Meyer's books seem to be filling the vacuum left behind by the end of the Harry Potter series. 11-year-old Ellie Cohen and 14-year-old Jojo Emerson have both moved on in their own way.
Once I saw Twilight, you know, I started reading it, and then I put down my Harry Potter books. I was like, never mind about these. Sorry. I don't like J.K. Rowling anymore. Actually, I am a purist and I do not like to mix my Harry Potter and my Twilight. I have a pile next to my bed and it's the 7 Harry Potter books and I have the 3 Twilight books. I don't want to get those worlds mixed because once I do, I know it's just going to go crazy.
If JoJo is worried about mixing up her imaginary worlds now, just wait till she reads Meyer's new book, The Host. Geared to the adult market, it's a science fiction romance where two women, one an alien from outer space, inhabit the same body and are in love with the same man. Meyer says writing dialogue for characters that share the same body wasn't a problem for her.
All of these characters in my other books, in this book, all of them take place in one head, mine. So I'm really used to internal conversations. That came pretty easily. I hear voices all the time.
And just as Meyer writes about good vampires in the Twilight books, she's created kinder, gentler alien invaders in The Host.
Some of my friends that read The Host when I was back and working on it in the rough draft stages told me, am I supposed to be rooting for the humans? Because I'm kind of not.
Meyer wants to attract an adult audience with her new book, but she also wants to keep her young fan base and hopes they'll give it a chance. 14-year-old Naran Matisse says Meyer has nothing to worry about.
I pretty much think she could write about a retirement community and we'd all read it. It's really, like, a given.
But Meyer does have one worry.
That they're going to pick it up and start flipping through it and be like, there's no Edward here. Where's Edward? And then they won't finish because they want more Edward.
Those young women who do want more Edward won't have long to wait. Breaking Dawn, the fourth book in the Twilight series, is due out in August with a first printing of 2.5 million books. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And you can read a chapter from Stephanie Meyer's new book, The Host, at npr.org/books.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne. As China rises to great power status at an astonishing pace, its neighbors in Asia and the United States are looking for clues to its intentions. Among them, China has built an unusual naval base that has rattled nerves across Asia. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
A tourism video of China's Hainan Island presents an idyllic oasis in the South China Sea. Beautiful women greet visitors. Waves crash onto a pristine beach. Palm trees sway in the wind. What the video does not show is an underground nuclear submarine base on the southern tip of the island. Recent satellite imagery on the websites of Jane's Intelligence Review and the Federation of American Scientists show large tunnels carved into the hillsides of the Sanya base. The entrance from the sea is large enough to allow submarines access to the underground facility. One image shows what appears to be a ballistic missile submarine at one of the piers. Kirk Campbell with the Center for a New American Security says the Sanya base reminds him of The Spy Who Loved Me.
The idea of an underground secret submarine base being put together by China is right out of a James Bond movie. The aspect of this that is stoked concern is the fact that it's hidden and underground.
China has been quietly but steadily modernizing its military over the past decade and has ambitions for its navy. U.S. military analysts believe China could build up to 5 nuclear-powered submarines capable of carrying ballistic missiles, each with the potential to deliver multiple nuclear warheads. Rumors of a nuclear submarine base have been swirling for years. Campbell says the satellite photographs confirm those suspicions and have created anxiety in the region about China's strategic capabilities and its intentions.
The reports of this secret facility have really shook a lot of Chinese neighbors, most particularly India, but also other countries in Southeast Asia have expressed considerable anxiety about just what the Chinese are up to.
India's naval chief, Admiral Suresh Mehta, said the base was, quote, a cause for security concern. India and China have a rivalry that goes back decades. Qin Gang, a foreign ministry spokesman in Beijing, would neither confirm nor deny the existence of the base, but said China's military policies are defensive.
There's no need for other nations to express worries about this or make baseless accusations or inappropriate comments.
Analysts say one of China's biggest reasons in building up its navy is to make sure sea lanes remain open so it can import desperately needed natural resources for its soaring economy. The location of the Sanya base could give China better access and dominance over disputed territories, such as the Paracel Islands and the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea. The naval facility will also give China more leverage over Taiwan, and the submarines take China one step closer to developing a blue water navy. Taylor Fravel with the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology says the base and the submarines are part of a larger nuclear program.
The deployment of the ballistic missile submarines will strengthen China's deterrent and take it closer to achieving a second strike capability. But this does not mean that China is developing or on the road towards developing the large nuclear force along the lines of the United States or Russia.
Bud Cole, a professor at the National War College and the author of a book on China's military, says adding some sea-based nuclear weapons will not make China the dominant force in the region. Cole says the U.S. has an overwhelming military edge when it comes to nuclear weapons. But, he says, the underground base in China is significant.
It's something that the United States Navy should be aware of and attempt to prepare for in our long-range planning, but I don't think it's a cause for alarm.
And Cole says China's Navy has many challenges as it develops a fleet of submarines capable of carrying ballistic missiles, including the training that's required for long-range patrols at sea and the advanced technology used on board. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.